Welcome to Real Vision. It's Monday, October 5th, 2020, just after market close in New York. This is the Real Vision Daily Briefing. I'm Ash Bennington, joined shortly by Ed Harrison. But first, the day's stories with Jack Farley. Welcome back, Jack.
Thanks, Ash. Great to be here as always.
So, Jack, what are you looking at in markets today?
Well, stocks are up today. Treasury yields are rising as well. Gold is posting some solid gains, and oil is up close to 7%. It's very near breaching the $40 level. So definitely a day of risk on, which to some may seem odd as the first trading day after we realized that the President of the United States had to be transported to Walter Reed Medical Center. But the dominant narrative seems to be that Trump's illness and his being in the hospital is going to bring people together. And by people, I mean the Republicans and the Democrats in the Senate. This theory first made the rounds with Speaker Pelosi on Friday, and then it's made its way into Wall Street sell-side research reports and the news stories that follow them. So it's now really become canon on Wall Street. So there's the adage in finance, good news is bad news and bad news is good news. This is taking that to the logical extreme, I'd say.
Jack, I gotta be honest with you, I don't understand anything anymore.
Me neither, Ash.
So quick note, we're filming this around 1 p.m. today. We're going to be filming the segment with Ed and I a little bit later in the day. So your mileage may vary. Markets may move.
Yes, definitely. So, I could look like a fool. So thanks for that note.
So, Jack, I know that you're also following the shock announcement from Cineworld.
Yeah, well, actually, thanks for pointing that out to me early this morning. I've been following it today. So Cineworld, it's the world's second largest publicly traded chain of movie theaters in the world. They announced they were closing all of their 536 Regal theaters in the U.S. and 127 additional Cineworld theaters in the U.K. The stock tanked on the news, opening down 60%. It's recovered a little bit. Now it's only down 37%. Its bonds are trading down as well. Reading just a few reports, that the future really depends on future funding. People saying it needs about $300 to $500 million of additional capital in order to stay solvent. It did price a note of £250 million in June. Whether it will be able to secure future funding, we'll see.
You know, Jack, talking about things that I don't understand, I've never understood the exhibitor business. That's the movie theater business here in the 21st century. Every time one of my film friends tells me that I don't understand the cinema experience, I say, I just bought a beautiful 4K TV for $499, great soundbar for $150, and I'm done. I'm done for the next 5 years. I don't really understand what cinemas add to the equation in 2020.
Well, Ash, I think a lot of people are beginning to think more like you. We're living in the age, it's Ash Bennington's world, we're just living in it. I was reading a report that said Mulan is judgment day for cinema business because they released it video on demand as well as in theaters, and it didn't do as well as anticipated. Also, there's a little bit of financial contagion within the business. AMC Theaters, which is another cinema chain, it was down 10% as well. I think it really stems from, you know, James Bond. It's going to be delayed until 2021. I think people are beginning to suspect that this isn't a bump in the road like it is for airlines. So, you know, airlines are going to have a really rough time of it. They may go bankrupt during COVID, but if they can emerge solvent and alive after the COVID pandemic has passed, it'll still be a solid business. People will still continue to fly, and it probably will increase. But perhaps for movies, you know, people will say, hey, no, I don't want to go to a movie theater. I want to watch Netflix. I want to watch Disney Plus or HBO. So yeah, it could be an accelerant of a secular trend there that may never reverse.
Yeah, exactly. This is one of my most hated contrarian opinions, but it's just going to cost you a fortune to take a family of four to a movie theater, including the, you know, 40-gallon drum of popcorn and parking and all that stuff. It's hard to understand that business model, for me at least. Jack, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Ash. Great to be here.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PIE, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know.
Trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to podcasts on.
Yeah, podcast, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus. Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
Ed, welcome back.
Thank you very much. It's good to be back. Happy Monday to you.
Happy Monday. Monday that begins risk on here at the end of the day, beginning the week risk on. So S&P up 1.8% on the day, closing at 3408 above the 34 handle. NASDAQ, big gainer of the major indices, 2.32%, up 3.2% to close at 11,332. And the Russell 2000 up even more than the NASDAQ, 2.79% to close at 1582. You know, Ed, earlier I taped the intro with Jack around 1 o'clock. Jack, who did a terrific job as always, was saying that the dominant narrative on Twitter and other places was that the reason that markets were rising was that President Trump was hospitalized and this somehow increased the probability of a deal with Nancy Pelosi. It didn't make any sense. I actually was joking with Jack saying, I don't understand anything. That comment has aged very well because now with news that Trump is going to be released from the hospital, markets up even further. So, you know, maybe we're just in a period here where the ability to construct narratives out of unrelated events is reaching its apex.
Yeah, you love it when something happens in the market and you have to have a reason why it's happening. And as you say, and as Jack was saying earlier, the insert the word amid, you know, that markets rise amid President Trump's demise in the hospital. And then, you know, you could say the exact same thing, except now it's amid his release from the hospital, right, as if there's some sort of connection between the two.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. It does seem as though, especially in periods of uncertainty, people are grasping to find reasons. They're trying to find ways of connecting the dots with narratives. And sometimes they just don't make any sense.
And, you know, tomorrow you're going to be able to talk to Tony Greer, who has a much more tactical view. He's not necessarily spinning any narratives. He's just looking at what the tape is telling him. I'm definitely going to be looking at it in this, you know, this RVDB from a longer term perspective. I like to look at the macro lens. So I'm definitely not going to be doing any amids in this view.
Yeah. You know, Ed, precisely to that point, you did an interview with David Rosenberg that aired, I believe, today, that I think is one of the great canonical pieces about this particular period of time, the challenges that we've had amid COVID, but in this case, literally amid. And I just wanted to read the quote that you opened that interview with, because I thought it was so powerful. This is coming from David Rosenberg's independent research. Quote, outside of the Treasury market, asset prices still don't reflect the economic depression because they have been so heavily sedated by unprecedented fiscal and monetary stimulus. Beneath the veneer, there is rot. And then he goes on to wonder aloud how long the government can mask the problems in the underlying economy. And finally, to say, at some point, the well will run dry. Nothing lasts forever. Powerful words from David Rosenberg.
Yeah. And, you know, I can't remember. I think it was Jack who or Max who put together the title, David Rosenberg in a Depression, Own What's Scarce. So, you know, the key word that jumped out at me off the page was depression. And, you know, Dave, he's been saying that, you know, I read what you've been writing. I take a similar view that this is not a recession. This is actually a depression that we're in right now. Even though people are talking about the V-shaped recovery and the snapback rally and all of that, when you look at it just from a macro lens, you know, zoom out. Don't zoom in at like the amids. We're looking at a depression that we're talking about now. And the question, therefore, is what does it mean in terms of how you're going to invest? What does it also mean from a policy perspective? He was getting to that a bit.
Yeah, I would call this one almost an internal peer-to-peer interview, because you guys went through your research together, unpacked a tremendous amount of data, and tried to sift through it in a way that made sense. So when you think about the things that David was talking about in terms of the data points, what were the ones that leapt out at you as most powerful, as most indicative of the narrative that you're seeing unfold?
Well, I think he was, for me, he was answering three questions. Actually, he answered two, and he's going to perhaps answer a third later. He was answering the question of, are we, what kind of cycle is this? What kind of economic cycle is this? Then the question is, given this cycle, what sort of policy response should we expect? I think that, you know, during our election coverage, he'll come back and he'll talk to that. He talked less to that here. This was an investment idea. So he talked more to what kind of investments do you want to have given this particular cycle? And so the first part of the narrative is about the Depression. And interestingly, if you think about a recession and the way that the National Bureau of Economic Research defines a recession, what they say is that a recession is a drop across a wide swath of different metrics, jobs. We're talking about industrial production, et cetera. And it's dispersed very greatly across the economy for, you know, weeks or months. There's no defined period. It's not the two quarters that people talk about. And in this particular recession that dated back from February, they said it was so deep and so broad that they had to say that even though it was probably, 2 months, 3 months in duration, or it could have even been less, you know, they called it in April that it had already happened in February, I think maybe April or May. So the difference, however, between a recession and a depression is the duration. That's that's where the rubber hits the road. So we saw a 6-year peak to trough to reemergence in terms of non-farm payrolls in the last cycle. That is from 2008 January to sometime in 2014. That was a makeup of about 9 million jobs. Right now, after the snapback, we're still at 11 million jobs to make up now, and so it gives you a sense of the magnitude of the downturn, and many of the jobs that we thought were temporary layoffs are now turning into permanent layoffs. So when you think about all this together, and you're forward looking into, you know, what could happen, he's saying it's a depression. And a depression is quite a different event psychically and also investment wise than a recession.
You know, if we haven't shown the chart already, the chart that shows currently employment down 10% with the context that during the depths of the great financial crisis, employment declined 1.5%. So some 7x times higher on a percentage basis right now. That chart is very striking.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is of a complete different magnitude. You could say, I mean, you know, one thesis is that because of the V-shaped snapback, that really this is just a small window in time. But the reality, now that we sit here 6-7 months after we had the lockdown begin, we're still at a level that of jobs that are missing from the economy to get back to the prior peak, which was in February. We're still 11 million below, and that's more than the great financial crisis, which is the worst recession in post-World War II history. So if this isn't a depression, I don't know what is.
Yeah. You know, the other conversation that you guys had that I found really compelling was when Rosenberg was unpacking some of the data around wages versus personal income, showing wages decline, personal income rising, effectively seeing government stimulus supplanting wage growth. You know, David's quote was that I thought was so interesting, quote, "The medication provided by the doctors was more than double the actual pain that the patient received." $2 trillion stimulus package that David ironically was saying is now viewed as skinny.
Yeah. And, you know, I think that there are two parts to that, and the way I'm thinking of it. One is about what should you do? And that's a contentious issue. And the second is about what can you do? I think we learned in the last financial crisis, and we're learning even more now, that you can do a lot more than people might have told you could do 20 years ago. And, you know, in terms of fiat currency issuers, there's a lot more leeway in terms of what you can do. People are talking about monetary theory and the ability to print money to basically, you know, to deficit spend your way out of a depression. I think that what Dave is basically saying is that, you know, there are limits to that. And if not in a absolute sense, there are limits in terms of a political sense. And so the concept that you can just continue to deficit spend ad infinitum, at some point you're gonna reach a wall, and people are gonna start to reel that back. We can see that actually with regard to the UK government, because the Chancellor of the Exchequer, Rishi Sunak, he's already talking about cutting back for future generations. So there's always going to be a certain degree of disquiet associated with this level of deficit spending that we're seeing now. I think the second thing goes to the contentious issue. What should you do? I mean, at a very basic level, I think what you should do is you should make sure that people aren't forced to make a decision between health and economics. When you have a large swath of people during a crisis where, you know, there's a contagious pandemic, making a decision, do I go to work? Do I send my kids to school with the possibility of our being sick because I have to do that? Then you're not doing a very good job in terms of being able to suppress the virus in a way that allows you the economy to power forward durably over the medium term. So a lot of the things that we're seeing now in terms of the virus coming back, we'll see how different countries deal with that. But to the degree that they just allow people to go back to work because they're forced to do so, otherwise, they'd lose their job and therefore they'll go back to work with the virus in hand. You're going to see those countries probably perform not so well from an economic perspective, because the virus will spread in a way that causes people to take fright.
Yeah, it's a great interview, and people should watch it in its entirety if they can. But Ed, how would you sum up your final takeaways from that conversation?
I would sum it up in terms of the investment thesis. He says in a depression, own what's scarce. And the way that I look at it is that we're in a period of secular stagnation. Even if you didn't call it a depression, you would definitely call it a secular stagnation. And right now, as we speak, the difference between growth and value is at a historic level, you know, in terms of how they're trading in the market. And this is a reflection of what people are seeing in terms of the scarcity of growth. So you have to invest for growth. You have to invest for yield. The real question is how can you do that in a way that is safe from mean reversion? That means that you're not doing it at a point where in the cycle, you have this huge dichotomy, and then you get caught out because that dichotomy diverges towards the mean. It's very tricky, and it doesn't necessarily mean that you want to hit up with the Nicolas of the world, because they get crushed 40% down. But there are companies out there that offer growth, dividend growth at a good price. I think he was talking to that in particular. You're looking at places where you can hide that are relatively safe from a growth perspective and also from a downside risk perspective. And the same is true on the yield side. The real question is where can you hide for yield without taking on undue risk from a credit perspective? Interestingly, I think that he talks about 30-year bonds in the U.S. I think that is a relatively contentious subject, because you are taking on duration risk there. And obviously, if the economy does better than we expect, if inflation goes up more than we expect, if interest rates go up more than we expect, we saw the 10-year bond go up today, then, you could get hurt.
Yeah. For people who didn't spend time in fixed income as you and I did, could you explain a bit about duration risk, how it works, and why it's especially relevant right now?
Yeah. So duration risk is basically means that the longer the maturity of the instrument that you're taking, that means the longer it takes for you to get your money back, all of your money back. And if you're getting a fixed income, if the yields, the interest rate environment moves against you, that money that you're getting back, because it's fixed in terms of the amount that you're getting back, it is worth less by far than if you had a smaller period of time during which you could reinvest. So if you have 2 years and then you can reinvest at the new higher yields, then it's much better than if you have 30 years before you can reinvest at the new higher yields.
Yeah, especially relevant for long dated paper, long maturity, and low coupon rates.
Exactly. So now that we have these really low rates, that duration risk is big in both directions. I've been saying that, you know, the convergence to zero is largely over. The only place that you can get it, Dave is telling you, is really at the long, long end of the spectrum. You can't get it in Europe. You can't get it in Japan, anywhere on the curve, but you can get it in treasuries, and you can only get it beyond 10 years. We're talking the 30-year bond and maybe even the 30-year strip. That is a zero coupon version of the 30-year bond.
Ed, why don't you jump in and do a little primer on zero coupon?
Yeah, so zero coupon means that's the longest of the long. That means you get absolutely nothing in terms of a coupon. Everything is all tied up in the balloon payment from the government 30 years out. So if you want duration, you want to get the maximum oomph, that's the place to be. But, you know, downside risk is the greatest there, as well as the upside risk.
Have you ever experienced turbulence on a flight and wondered why?
And you can see all the terrain around you. You've got no issue with visibility or anything?
No, everything's peachy.
Maybe you've sat on the tarmac for hours wondering why your plane isn't moving.
Well, we're outside here. They're saying the ramp is closed. They won't let us park because of Air Force One.
Listen in on the conversations between pilots and air traffic controllers on the Air Traffic Out of Control podcast.
510, is he declaring an emergency? There's smoke in the cabin. I need to make a landing right now on 31 left.
We have the most interesting, wild, and funny ATC recordings you will ever hear. Check out Air Traffic Out of Control wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Yeah, and they're called strips because they strip off the coupons to create synthetic securities that de facto become zero coupon bonds.
Exactly.
Yeah, very well said, Ed. A lot to digest there.
Yeah, great interview. He always does well on the platform. He's a great explainer. You can always take issue with the outcomes, but the analysis in terms of, you know, what you're faced with in this particular time is spot on. You know, you're not faced with good prospects either for growth or for yield, and you really have to mind your P's and Q's to be able to get through that.
Yeah. Yeah. U.S. Treasury 30-year bond, currently priced yield 1.58%.
So, you know, let me take you to a different place, because you talked about a interview that I was doing. There's an interview that you were doing. I think it came out on Friday.
Yeah.
It's with a guy by the name of Estes. I thought it was a great interview. This is on the crypto platform. I'm not like a huge crypto guy, but I really found that it was a great human interest story in terms of this guy's particular transformation in terms of leaving traditional finance and then moving into crypto, and, you know, how he's become very ensconced in that space.
Yeah, Brian Estes, CIO and managing partner at Off the Chain Capital. One of my favorite crypto pieces that we've done thus far. You know, it's interesting if you're really interested in the crypto space. He's the Bitcoin OG you may not have heard of before. He's been involved in this for many years, and he knows everyone of consequence in the space. He's had a pretty incredible career. So if you're a crypto person, it's definitely an interview for you. If you're not a crypto fan, it's a terrific piece, I think, just as a general conceptual toolkit for how investors think about the world. Brian's a very smart guy. And just listening to his thought process, he explains how he reached some of the conclusions that he reached and then went on to put a great deal of skin in the game. A lot of his personal, not just net worth, but his time and energy and effort walking away from a successful career as a traditional capital markets investor. It's just a great, it's also just an inspiring personal story.
Yeah. That was the part that got me, is the personal story. Very inspiring. He's very upbeat, you know, because he's had some adversity. I'm not going to give away what that adversity is, but, you know, I just found it a remarkable interview, and he's a remarkable human being.
Yeah. I will say this, though. Pretty much every success that he had always begins with someone telling him, no, Brian, I'm sorry, you can't invest in this. We can't let you do it. You can't do this. You can't do that. And the story about how he overcame effectively all of his big trades, all of his big investments were, you know, when, after someone had told him no, usually several times.
You know, before I give up on this line in terms of this interview, the interesting bit that I found when you talk about that is the no that he got for concentrating the portfolio.
Yeah.
And to me, that also opened up the mind about how he thinks about things.
Yeah.
It's similar, actually, to how Warren Buffett thinks about. He's like, you know, a lot of people say diversify. Don't put all your eggs in one basket. But, you know, Warren Buffett says put your eggs in one basket, but watch that basket, you know. And he's essentially saying the same thing in that he's saying, I made these concentrated bets. Why? Because he talked about the S curve, where, you know, during the first period of growth, the growth from 0 to 10% of penetration happens at the same rate as the move from 10 to 90. So you want to be at that first part there. That's where you can get in before the thing goes vertical. I mean, the shift from here to here is massive.
Yeah, that's one of those great kind of conceptual toolkit pieces that he talks about. He learned that in Isaac Newton's classroom at Cambridge.
Right.
It's a great story. It's also interesting. I was just looking, you know, he has only a few hundred Twitter followers. If someone you're looking to get into early and to say, I was following Brian Estes before anyone else, now is your time to do it. Final point on that interview, Ed, which I think is kind of interesting, and I don't think we've discussed this yet, but I did the interview in a very different way. Typically, the conversations that you and I have, the conversations we have with other guests, they tend to be highly thematic in nature. This one was really following the life story, the arc of Brian, and this is something that you know, we're thinking, I'll break a little bit of news here. We're exploring some different ways of doing podcasts. And this is one of the things that I'm thinking a great deal about, is how that we can build podcasts and other types of interviews where we can follow the narrative arc of people's lives. Because I think in Brian's case, especially, you can see how understanding someone's life sequentially and the lessons they learned become incredibly important to understanding the philosophy and the mechanics of how he makes his investments.
Right. Yeah, spot on. Because that's what the phase shift that I saw in terms of the interview with the investment in growth stocks. I think that's where I saw, aha, you know, that's where the light bulb went on in terms of how he ended up getting into the crypto world.
Yeah. Yeah. It really does tee it up quite brilliantly. You can see the leaps taking place, and you can understand how he was able to identify those opportunities in the crypto space based on the way he was investing in the tech stock space. And perhaps also as a consequence of some of the resistance that he had to making the investments that were ultimately so successful for him.
Right. Yeah, exactly. That was my takeaway as well.
Yeah. So talking of successful investors, in case you missed Friday's daily briefing, this week we're kicking off our live guest Q&As in the exchange. This week we have Ted Seides of the Capital Allocators podcast, bond expert George Goncalves of Macro Hive, and investment strategies Lynn Alden, who's a favorite on the Real Vision platform. We've posted the links in the description, so go ahead and jump in and add your questions now if you'd like to be heard. So Ed, what else are you looking at today?
I think the last thing that I'm looking at is that, you know, I told you about Rosenberg and how he has three things that came out of that. One was the, you know, are we in a depression, recession, how to think about it. At a minimum, secular stagnation, I think it's a depression. The third thing was, what's your investment philosophy? He was talking about growth. He was talking about yield. The second part is about what happens in How do you do? How do you get a policy response from this? And I talked a little bit about this with Rishi Sunak. I think this is very relevant to how we're thinking about coverage of the election, because at a very macro level, what you have to understand is that irrespective of whatever happens, if you have a divided Congress in the United States, nothing's going to get done from a stimulus or a deficit perspective. However you look at it, positively or negatively, if you want a supply side from Trump and you want stimulus on the investment front, you're not going to get it if you have the Democrats holding the House of Representatives. On the other side of things, if Biden were to win and you have the Senate held by the Republicans, he's not going to get what he wants. He's not going to be able to deficit spend in the way that he wants to, and especially not the way that the left of the Democratic Party wants to. So to me, you have a very starkly different outcome with a divided government versus a one-party government. And so the way that I'm thinking about this is that you have two outcomes almost, and you have to go down from those two outcomes. One is divided government in the United States, and the other is a uniform government in the United States. Those are two specific types of outcomes. Why? Because we're in a period of extreme economic stress, almost to the point of depression. I would call it a depression. And when you have divided government, you're not going to be able to solve the problems of that extreme economic problem.
Now, Ed, that's an analysis that actually makes sense to me, unlike what we hear from the astrologers and soothsayers reading tea leaves in hospital admissions. Just doesn't make any sense.
If you're facing a existential type of crisis, war, famine, depression, and you can't get it together, you're gonna, because you have a division that's very stark, then that opens up worst case scenarios economically and otherwise. So I think that you have to look at that, and then you have to look at the other side. So those are the two scenarios that I'm looking at purely from an economic perspective. And when we do our election coverage, that's kind of how I'm framing it. Those are the kind of questions I want to drill down on when we talk to our analysts about what they see in the markets, what they see in the economy.
Yeah, me too. And I would just add one other additional wrinkle to that, which is the degree of political polarization that we have in the country right now. Divided government during the best of times makes reaching rapid decisions more challenging. In the current environment, it's a very difficult prospect to understand how major decisions can get made in the case of emergencies.
Yeah. One last thing, since you're asking me what am I thinking about? I'm thinking about the U.S. and the U.K. as being more similar to each other and other countries as being different in terms of division. So if you look at the rest of Europe, say Germany, you look at the Netherlands, you look at Sweden, the way that they've come together during the crisis, I think, is different than the way that the U.S. and the U.K. have come together. I think that the U.S. and the U.K. are more divided. So in the U.K., you actually had the election that you needed to have. There's no divided government because they have a parliament and they can get things done. But to a degree, I think that you can get a sense of what's coming down the pike by looking at the UK, what's coming down the pike in the US by looking at the UK. They're more similar to one another in terms of how they're dealing with the problems. That's just my hypothesis than other countries, which are dealing with it in a much more cohesive and unified way.
Yeah, it's interesting. Under a parliamentary system, the prime minister is effectively, in some ways, analogous to a combination of the president and the speaker of the House. But as you point out, Ed, they have deep-seated divisions in their culture, in many ways analogous to what we have in the United States. So it is definitely a cultural challenge there as well to get things done.
Yeah. So for me, something to watch. Maybe this Thursday, I can pick Roger's brain, what he sees there. But obviously, every country is different. I just think that this election season is one of the few that's going to have meaningfully big impacts on the economy instead of vice versa.
Yeah, very well said. Ed Harrison, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Ash. Always a pleasure.